All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. How's it going? Are you all right? This is it. This is the week, the beginning of the holiday season. This is where we've already weighed whether, maybe some of you still are on the fence. I don't know. We've already weighed whether or not we're going to have people over. We're going to have family over. We're going to go see our families. We're not going to see our families. We're going to go to a thing at someone else's house who we don't really like that much, but we don't have any other plans and we can put up with it for a night. They're okay people, but we don't really hang out with them any other time. But it's nice to be around other people with families and whatnot if we're not going to go see our family. Maybe you're doing that thing, or maybe you're just having a quiet night at home, avoiding the entire Thanksgiving event and situation. Maybe you do that. You just have like a sandwich, maybe a soda, and you kind of relish in the fact that you've turned your back on this family and national tradition, but yet you still watch the dog show the next day because that's something to be excited about, huh? The grooming, right? All those different shapes of dogs, purebreds, that's exciting. The parade, not great. Anyways, I guess my point is, how are you fortifying your mind and heart in preparation for, I don't want to say confrontation. Maybe some of you are just can't wait. You can't wait to get to mom and dad's house or grandma's house, or maybe you've got kids and they're excited to see grandma, even though you don't really like her that much. I don't know what your situation, but I know it's on your mind. It's on my mind, but I'm focusing on food. Today on the show, I talked to Kenneth Lonergan. Kenneth Lonergan is a playwright and screenwriter. You might know him from winning an Academy Award for Manchester by the Sea. He also did the film Margaret, wrote and directed that, and You Can Count on Me was his film. Several plays. I just saw one of them in New York that's been revived, I think. I don't know if it's called a revival, if it's just put up again. Is it still a revival if it's not old as hell? But the Waverly Gallery, which he wrote in 2000, is now up in New York. It's got Elaine May in it. Joan Allen is in it. Michael Cera is in it. Great writer, and I was a little intimidated. I always assume I'm going to be outgunned intellectually by people who do who write theater. I don't know why that is. I guess I have a place in my heart and in my mind that is threatened by people that have the wherewithal to write plays. I guess I put a lot of stock in the possibility of theater and what it can do. And I find that some plays are more abstract. Those are the ones that always get me. After, I think it was early on when I started reading or seeing Sam Shepard plays where I'm like, where the fuck does this come from? But I'm still sort of intimidated and nervous when I talk to playwrights. But Kenneth Lonergan and myself had a great conversation. He came to the hotel in New York and we sat there and listened to sirens through the window and talked about New York and about plays and about all kinds of stuff. It was actually an interesting thing happened after we had the conversation. Maybe I'll remember to tell you what that was. There's a Black Friday sale at podswag.com, which is where you can get all WTF merch. I want to make sure you know this. It's 40% off the entire site this Friday, so you can get discounts on items from lots of your favorite podcasts. Go to podswag.com. That's podswag.com to check out everything that's there, or go right to podswag.com/WTF and get a new Draplin WTF shirt or some of the new signed posters or a signed copy of Waiting for the Punch. It's all 40% off this Friday, November 22nd. And I did put those posters in, those hand screened giant posters from my Phoenix show. Just got those over there, just signed a bunch of books. So yeah, do that. So how are you preparing? What's going on? Thanksgiving's coming up. I think I'll do a dispatch from Florida. I haven't gone down there in a couple of years, and because I've been shooting generally. GLOW is not going to start shooting until after Thanksgiving this year, so I get to go down, and I generally cook, and I'm making some changes this year. It's a big choice. It's a big decision. How will they be received? The changes to the menu that I'm going to incorporate. And this is, I do think pretty heavily about it, about the food, because I haven't been eating much. It's time to start eating again, by the way. I'm glad I waited till Thanksgiving and I waited till the beginning of the GLOW season, the shooting. I took off a bunch of weight. I took off, like, Jesus, as of today, probably around 15 pounds. And most of it was just in preparing to start shooting again, because those pants that I wear on Glow, the one pair of pants, I think we're integrating a second pair perhaps this season, but they get a little snug towards the end of the shooting. There's just food all around. I eat shit all the time over there. Well, I try not to, but then you end up eating. Yeah, I'll just have have a half a donut. You know what? I'll have a quarter of donut, and then, you know, I'll loop back around. I'll get that other quarter, and if no one ate that other half, maybe I'll eat that. Eating a donut in that way can be it can take a half a day. But so I'm ready to go eat Thanksgiving. I know you're probably just wondering, well, how are you changing your menu, Mark? What is it that you're doing? I'll tell you. The big change is that I generally do a sweet potato thing, just a standard kind of like streusel topped sweet potato thing. That's almost like a dessert. But I think that's out. I think it's out. And I know some of you are going to be like, why would you remove that? I'm like, because there's a healthier and more interesting way to eat sweet, squashy, sort of sweet potato-y kind of shit. And I've come up with this recipe that I believe I invented, and I'm going to share this with you because it's simple. If you take that, how do you say it? Kombucha? Is it kombucha squash? Kombucha, maybe? You know, the squash, it looks like a pumpkin that doesn't, that's fighting, turning yellow. It's kind of, kombucha, I believe, is a squash. It doesn't matter. Do you want me to tell you the recipe? Do you want me to tell it to you? Because this is what I'm doing. I'm sharing a recipe with you. That's something friends do. So you take the kombucha, you cut it up, you gut it, you take all the seeds out, you clean all the stringy shit out of it, and then you slice it into little triangles. I don't make them too thin. I like them maybe 2.5 inches on one side and then up to the point. And then what I do, I'm telling you, it's good. Get some ghee, get some clarified butter, make it so it's liquidy, and then put it in a little bowl, and then just coat each piece of the kombucha squash with the ghee, and then sprinkle all of it with garam masala, which is an Indian spice. It's got usually like cumin, coriander, some cardamom, cloves, black pepper, cinnamon, sometimes nutmeg, and there's different versions of it. But just do the ghee and do the garam masala, and then salt them up, and then roast them until they brown a bit. And that's it. It's like all those, like half of those spices, half of the Indian spices just happen to be Thanksgiving spices. So you're kind of sneaking in something exotic with something that is also well-founded in the tradition of hackneyed turkey day stuff. Am I making too much out of it? Do you think that maybe my obsession with this squash as I head to Florida in the next couple of days to cook might be masking some of the other feelings I might be having about going down to Thanksgiving and seeing my mom? My brother's coming down. I'm flying him down. We haven't been together with my mother in a long time for Thanksgiving. My cousins, time passing, people getting older. And it's Florida too. By the end of the week, it could be underwater, or there could be chaos in the streets over some predicament. Florida is a chaotic place that is sadly trending red. But that red will be put out by the slow sinking of the state because of a denial that it's happening and that we have anything to do with it. Water in the streets in Florida. But I'm telling you, the squash is going to be the shit. Don't be afraid to eat the skin. Don't be afraid to eat the skin in life. A quick email. This one was funny. I like to try to help out. You know what I mean? I'm not perfect in any way, but if I can help out, that's nice. Marin drops F-bomb in my meeting. That's the subject line. Good day, Mark. I drive to work every day and listen to your podcast as I snake through the shitty Sydney traffic that inevitably happens in the central business district where I work. I finished listening to the Kurt Vile episode and the Busy Phillips episode began to play. As I pulled into my garage, it was only 6 minutes and 56 seconds into it before I jumped out of my car and went up to my office. I was in my weekly sales meeting with all my offices across Australia on a video conference call and had my phone on the boardroom table as I was expecting an important call about a contract, so it was within eyesight. With the ringer switched off. Just as my colleague in Melbourne was speaking, all that was heard from Sydney was, "Who gives a fuck?" followed by, "I fuck up the lead, who gives a shit?" Yes, For some inexplicable reason, your podcast started playing on my phone by itself, on speaker. What was creepy is that the phone was untouched for 30 minutes and some poltergeist shit went down as I scrambled embarrassingly to stop this tirade being confused as my own, as I am Canadian, and to an untrained ear, people around the other offices may have actually thought it was me swearing. Coincidentally, you did actually say what I was feeling about my weekly meeting, so thanks for that. After the meeting, my colleagues in Sydney asked what the podcast was, and I told them WTF, you might actually get three more signups. Well, I wasn't fired, and people saw the humor in what happened. Thanks for breaking up the monotonous Monday meeting dread with a well-timed F-bomb. Cheers, Justin. Glad to help out, Justin. Glad to help out. There's one other one here. Big ask. Hello, I have a huge request to ask of Mark Maron. I would be super grateful if whoever reads this could pass along my message to him. Well, I'm reading it. My mom is a huge fan of the WTF podcast. She has a Boomer Lives mug that she proudly displays as her main coffee mug, and she's the one usually telling me about a new great episode. She's been having some medical issues lately with her shoulder involving multiple surgeries, and she's really bummed out about it because her recovery is not going well. This all being said, my huge request is this. I was wondering if there was any way I could buy some merch as a present and have Mark sign it to her. She's going in for further surgery in December, and she's been in a really sad place for a while, and I just know that something like this would really help her spirits. I know this is a huge ask, and Mark, if you read this, thanks for even considering. Sincerely, Phil. Yeah, we can work that out, Phil, but then you got to buy it and you got to send it to me, and it's a long process, so I then said, what's her name, to Phil? And he said, thanks for the reply. Her name is Rosanna. And I don't want to mention last names, but Rosanna with the shoulder issues. It's going to be all right. All right. It's hard to bounce back when you're older. Takes time. But, you know, you're lucky it's just a shoulder and not an organ or a brain or losing a foot. Did that help, Rosanna? Okay. All right. So, Kenny Lonergan, Kenneth Lonergan. I don't think I know him well enough to call him Kenny, but I think some people call him Kenny. Kenneth Lonergan. We talked in my hotel room in New York. We had a nice conversation. And before I talked to him, I made sure to catch up on some stuff. I never watched Margaret. And I know it was sort of a movie that got mixed response. And I knew there was some sort of, I don't know if it was controversy, but it was a difficult movie on a lot of levels, and I talked to him about it, but I watched it, and I thought it was a pretty stunning film. And what's my point about this? Okay, I'll tell you. Kenneth and I had one of those conversations after the mics went off that I wish it was on, but we were talking about, we talked about Margaret during the interview, but then afterwards, because Elaine May is in his play, Elaine May, who is in the very influential and famous comedy team, Nichols and May, but also went on to write many movies. Elaine May directed The Heartbreak Kid, and I brought up The Heartbreak Kid after we turned the mics off, which is a great movie, one of my favorite movies with Charles Grodin, Sybil Shepherd, Eddie Albert. And I just watched Margaret, but we talked about The Heartbreak Kid being one of the great movies that really rides the line appropriately between tragedy and comedy in a way that's just painful and beautiful. It's a stunning movie. And then I asked him, you know, whatever happened, because Elaine May's daughter was in The Heartbreak Kid. And I'm like, whatever happened to her? And he was like, she's in Margaret. And I'm like, who? And she played a part in Margaret that was devastating. Her name's Jeannie Berlin. And I had no idea what happened to her. And I just watched her in a 3-hour movie be a genius. And it was so thrilling, really. I just love moments like that. But sadly, we didn't have that conversation on the mics. But kudos and respect to The Heartbreak Kid. Anyways, I'm trying to introduce Kenneth Lonergan. Elaine May's a genius. Elaine May's great in his play. Okay, so this is me talking to Kenneth Lonergan in a hotel room in New York City. His play, The Waverly Gallery, is now on Broadway with Elaine May, Joan Allen, Lucas Hedges, David Cromer, and Michael Cera. It's playing at the Golden Theater through the end of January. Okay, listen to us talk. Nice to see you. We've never met before, ever?
No, I don't think so.
I feel like, I don't know why, I guess I feel like I know you. I don't know why that happens sometimes with people. Or maybe we have common friends.
It's possible.
I don't know. I've talked to people in your movies. I've talked to Casey.
Yeah.
you know, for the movie.
Yeah.
I might have seen you at a award show of some kind.
It's possible.
Yeah.
There were a lot of them last 2 years ago.
No kidding, right?
Oh, yeah.
To start, like, I saw the play, the older play that is up again, mm-hmm. Waverly Gallery last
yeah.
night.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how much, when something like that is redone, how much do you have to do with it?
It depends completely on the production, but this one I had a lot to, I was there a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't direct it. Lila Neugebauer directed it, but I was there a lot, you know, very involved in the casting and the whole process. You know, if you're the playwright, you can do as much as you want, really.
If you're around, they're like, yeah, let him come
yeah,
in.
Yeah, they like to have you around if you're not a pain in the ass. I try not to be.
And what was different about staging it this time?
Well, it's different when it's a, you know, the first time it was staged in 2000, and you know, the first time you ever do a play, it's a little more maybe you're a little more precious about how it's done, and you know it's like it's a big deal. This is a big deal too, but I don't know, you just I guess you're just more possibly a little less flexible if you're the writer, but I mean you have to be flexible anyway because it's a cast and a director and doesn't work
big sets, bigger sets.
Well, now there's bigger sets. No, because it's on Broadway now. It was on off Broadway before.
So originally, was it just one set?
It was one set with a rotate with a turntable at the very end. It's a hard, you know, when I wrote the play, I wasn't really thinking too clearly about the sets. It's a little awkward the way the set goes because it goes back and forth between two locations until the middle of the second act, and then there's suddenly a hallway, and then there's suddenly a new apartment that we haven't seen.
Right.
And it doesn't sound like a big problem, but it can be because
in
you have to
theater.
In a smaller theater, even in the bigger theater, that's still hard to solve because if you have one set, you've got this big space that you don't use until the last scene. If you don't do that, then you have to figure out a way to introduce it in the middle of the action. Also, it's a continuous thing. They go from the hallway into the final apartment, and you have to figure out how, it's a design challenge.
Yeah,
because not elegantly thought out by the writer
and that guy.
Yeah.
And when now it's very autobiographical.
Yeah it is.
And you grew up here in New York.
Yeah
and that, like, because I grew up with some of that same Jewish history.
Mm-hmm.
And
where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in New Mexico, but my family's from Jersey. So I had a communist great aunt in Fort Lee.
Oh, yeah.
I had my grandma Goldie in New Jersey.
Yeah.
My grandma Eleanor in Bayonne.
Yeah.
Asbury Park. But I just find that, like, that whole generation, that history, that somebody that has that proximity to the Nazis and to that kind of stuff, that they're almost all gone.
Yeah, they're pretty much gone now. I guess there's a few hanging on, but, you know, my grandmother was born in 1903.
Yeah.
And she was 80 in her late 80s, in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she'd be, you know, 115 now. So, they're pretty much gone.
And it's like, is it like sort of this amazing gift to have to, like, I guess we're really the last generation of grandkids that were able to talk about that. And even the way that the set is designed with that type of art, there's something very specific about that sort of progressive, old school Jewish experience.
Yeah.
That really reads. And Elaine May did a great job with it.
Yeah, she's amazing. And the whole thing, you know, that and she's from, my grandmother, and the character in the play is from a very particular demographic. She grew up in Brooklyn. Her parents were immigrants. But then she quickly came to Manhattan and Greenwich Village and lived a kind of a bohemian lifestyle.
Right.
She was a soft American communist. She was interested in the art scene. She was mostly interested in socializing. But she was very politically active. Was a member of the American Labor Party and did all sorts of. Went to lots of meetings with people like Dashiell Hammett and lived around the corner from Eleanor Roosevelt after FDR had died, and used to see her walking her dog in the park, and she kind of knew everybody.
Yeah.
And really kind of exemplified the Greenwich Village scene in the 40s and 50s.
Do you still live in the city?
Yeah, I do. I live in Soho now.
Do you find, like, are you experiencing, because some of that, there was some nostalgia involved in looking in the way they projected some of the film pieces
mm-hmm.
onto the set.
Yeah.
Does your heart sort of break for what was the city?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's very much so. And I mean, the city's never stayed. It's always been in flux. It's always changing. But
it's part of the play.
Yeah, it is part of the play. But it's hard to miss New York City in the 1970s. It was such a sewer. But it's now seems to me to be kind of getting back to that. It's dirtier. It's noisier. The construction's gone insane. It's horrible. And the whole city's been taken over by these buildings and all these construction projects. The subway's a disaster. It's really gotten
the infrastructure's breaking.
Infrastructure is a disaster.
But am I wrong in noticing that? It feels like I don't really know who the people are here anymore.
Well, I don't feel quite that way. I feel like it's still the same balance. There's still a balance of native New Yorkers, people who come in from the outside, and then commuters who come in and out.
As many can live here.
It's much more expensive to live here. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, my grandmother wasn't wealthy, but she bought a building. You know, she always had some money because her father was pretty well off, and they bought a building on Washington Place in 1940, I don't think for a lot of money, and she was a landlady to small 8-unit apartment building.
What happened to the building?
It's been sold, but and now they're redoing it. I'm sure they're gonna, it's been under construction for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and I know it's going to be some $20 million single residence palace.
Really?
Oh yeah, I know that's.
Yeah, those people. Where are they coming from?
I don't know. I think a lot of them are foreign. I think the building was sold to a German corporation of some kind, and I don't know who they sell it to. I don't know who could afford those rents. You look at the apartments for sale in New York City, it's like $20 million, $7 million for a little one. I mean, it's really gone crazy.
I can't ever tell, because I spent time here. I lived here for many years, and I can't tell if I'm being old and sort of back in the day it was this or that, and the people were different, but it just feels like the tone of the city has gotten... maybe it's because there seemed to be a more vital art scene. I don't know where you came up in playwriting.
Here. I mean, I think this art scene is, I think everything that's in it is still here, except for the middle income people who are able to live in Manhattan, but which is a huge difference. But I mean, to me, it's the physical. I mean, we're listening to sirens right now. You never don't hear sirens anymore. You never don't hear construction. You never.
Jackhammers.
Took me 40 minutes to get here, to get 40 blocks.
Yeah.
There's no way to get around. Subway's broken. The streets are clogged. And all this construction creates more and more traffic problems, and will create traffic problems when it's done, because people have to people have to go somewhere.
They're not
going to
stop making people, and they're not going to stop making cars.
No, and they're not going to stop building these buildings. It's just like this. It's literally like the face of greed. These fucking buildings. I just hate them.
I don't know what fills them. Every time I'm in a hotel like this, and I just look across the way at people working during the week, I'm sort of like, oh my god. Well, what's happening over
there?
A
lot of them go bust. I mean, NYU, for instance, is building this enormous, they keep building and building and building in the village, and they can't, the people who are, I don't know a lot about it, but the people who get the contracts and provide the contracts are making a fortune. The school is not able to put enough students in these dorms.
Right.
And it's not a money-making proposition in the end, except for the people who skim off the top when they're being built. So that's kind of who's taken over the city.
They're just empty buildings.
I think so.
And ghost vessels.
But it's not for the people who live here.
Right.
And New York has never been totally for the people who live here. But now it's just, there's no sense of public life at all. It's more like, it's kind of like the whole city's like a big fuck you to the people who are here, because you cannot get around.
Yeah.
And it's just, and I've lived here my whole life, and it's, you know, part of living in New York, as you know, is always complaining about how different it is and how it's gotten worse, but it really, really has.
So it's the same evolution that's in the play.
Except
now what it's turning into, it lacks any real character.
Yeah, and these neighborhoods, I live in I used to live in the village, and now I live in Soho, Bleecker Street, even during the big changes in the 60s and 70s, was still local businesses that had been there for a long time. In the last 10, 15 years, they've been wiped out. It's Ralph Lauren and all these designer stores, and now they're all shut because Ralph Lauren could pay those rents.
So you can just buy online.
Yeah, so Bleecker Street, they wipe out the local businesses, and then they collapse under the weight of their own expenses, and then they're not certainly not going to sell those spaces to local businesses anymore.
So what does the future hold?
It's more of this, I think. It's like, honestly, you walk around here, it's like a dystopian society. It's
the whole country, the whole world.
I know, you cannot believe what's out there. Just getting to the theater, I live a pretty, exalted lifestyle compared to most people, you know.
Yeah.
Not super rich, but anyone who's, you know, doing well is doing better than everybody else. And my God, you get to, just going back and forth to work is like, it's like a marathon of garbage noise and and honking horns. We've been here for 10 minutes. We haven't heard the siren stop once.
Well, I'm trying to like figure out. It's like I watched Margaret last night because I hadn't seen it. I've seen the other movies and I've seen the one play, but I don't get to the theater a lot because I don't live here. And, when I was watching the play and realizing that, you know, you're half Jewish, half Irish.
Yeah.
And I found that there was sort of I could see a balance in the writing, you know, that in the sense that, you know, you seem to be existentially Irish and intellectually Jewish.
Well, I wouldn't know about that.
No, but I mean, the message, because of the character that Elaine May plays, your grandmother, you know, is naturally sort of buoyant and engaged,
yeah,
and intelligent and charming and funny, even in the middle of her losing her mind. There's sort of a comedy there. There's a pace to it.
Yeah.
Right. And with Michael Cera as well, there is a deliberate sense of comedy there, but there is no escaping the bleakness.
No, there really isn't.
And I guess that's an honest way to look at life, but it seems fundamentally Irish to me.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I guess so.
Shoulder it.
Well, I think the play is supposed to be somewhat of an argument against sentimentality. We all go through these difficult and terrible things, not all day long and not every day and not every year, but when you do, I think it's worthwhile to be frank about it.
Yeah, but also but the interesting thing about, there was never an argument in the play, and even when you wrote it, it seems that even at that time, there was sort of a natural sort of, let's put her in a home. But,
it didn't work that way. And in the play, in my life, my mom just didn't want to put my grandmother in a home, and she also, it's a little hard, you know, the problem is with all elderly people who are not doing well is that you have this terrible, you can't leave them alone. Most of the time they don't live in the same family, most of the time they don't live in the same house as the rest of the family. It's difficult to take care of them at home, especially if you don't have the income to pay for help. If it's a working family, you can't leave them alone at home. You move them with you. It's very much of a strain. And then the alternative is to put them in a nursing home. And anyone who thinks that anyone enjoys that is just fooling themselves. So, and very few people are out of it to the point where they don't know where they are.
Right.
So it's a terrible dilemma. And my mom solved it by taking the burden onto herself. But on the other hand, she couldn't have done that if she didn't have the income to pay for help. No single person can take care of someone who's demented and wandering around all day long. It's not possible.
So it's not sentimental, but it is, you know, sort of responsible and loyal and with a certain amount of love that this is done. Yeah. And an incredible amount of tolerance and patience.
That's a lot of people do it. I mean, a lot of people figure out a way. They move back home to take care of their parents. And sometimes they just can't, you know. That's not because they don't love them as much. They just don't have the capacity to care for them properly.
But also in the character that represents you in terms of the what's his name?
Daniel.
Like, you were able to, at the end, you know, process this stuff, that you can hold both memories in your mind. You have that, how she ended and who she was.
Yeah.
Is one continuum, and to make sure you remember the other part. It may not be sentimental, but it's necessary.
Yeah, I hope it's the opposite of sentimental. I mean, to me, sentimentality is a way to avoid real emotion. It's kind of looking at yourself having the emotion rather than looking at the situation that is difficult. And I think it's a way to soft pedal, just to make it more tolerable. You have this sort of sweetsy saccharine bullshit.
Yeah,
it's all okay in the end. It's her time. You know, all that crap. Nobody thinks it's their time. Right. You know, nobody wants to go. People hold on to very, very little.
Yeah.
Because it's worth being alive. And they, not to quote myself, but people really want to hang around and be functioning and have a life. And it's kind of easy for those of us who are not in the hot seat to kind of at some point let them go. And this is life. But if you're the one who's on your way out, it's not something you want to do. And I think there's a certain amount of respect you can give to, you can try to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's really going through something you're not, and try to behave towards them as you would like someone to behave towards you if you, when you're in trouble.
Is it sort of an aesthetic mission of yours to completely make sure that you know, sentimentality is put in its place?
Partly, yeah. I just hate it. I think it's such a lie. It's such a filthy lie, and I don't. And I think it makes people feel isolated.
More sirens.
More sirens. There's something about.
It's also incredibly self-centered, I guess. And if you explore it the way you just did with me, there is just that it's something we do to relieve ourselves from a certain amount of emotional responsibility.
Yeah, and to it's kind of, it's a lie, you know. It's a lie that everything's okay, and I don't believe in rubbing people's noses and the fact that everything's not okay. But there's something about the common experience of not, of things going badly. I've had a lot of people, to my surprise, come up to me, you know, back then when we first did the play, and now, like, just say that was really, it was really rough, but there's something good about seeing your experience reflected back to you accurately. You don't feel so alone. A lot of times when people, especially in this culture, when people are in trouble, everybody's been in trouble, but you're kind of pushed off to the side. You're relegated to a role in the margins. It's not really woven into the way we live to, you know,
take care of each other.
And people do privately, but it's not a communal experience, and not, maybe it shouldn't be, but there's something that's very isolating about, you have your friends and your family, hopefully, but there's something, you're not, it's almost as if you're not, you're a downer and you're not in life with everybody else. And of course you are. But anyway, so I think there's something valuable in just being frank about it. And there's something valuable about just in itself, just trying to be truthful.
Well, I've thought out loud about the fact that I think that, you know, most of us are built to shoulder or to sort of at least be able to show up for other people in a fairly present and honest way without it collapsing us. But it seems that because of the pace of technology and emotional selfishness, that people dismiss people. But I do think that, you know, we're naturally able to sort of show up for people that in the worst of situations, and it takes less than you think.
I think. And people really look out for each other in a really great way,
innately. And that's something you see in this city. It's like at the beginning of Margaret, even with that horrible accident in New York, I mean, there's going to be 100 people trying to help out without a second delay.
No, I think that's true, and I think it's a really good thing, and that's partly what the play is about too. It's how, you know, but I think it's, you know, both as a play and in life, you know, it's also works better dramatically, but if you don't sugarcoat how rough the experience is, you're giving more value to the effort people make to deal with it.
Right. See, it's a balance.
Yeah, there's a balance, and adversity does often bring out the best in people. If you have a friend in the hospital, just walking through those grimy little halls and seeing all the open doors with all the relatives sitting in these chairs, it's depressing to see people sick, you know, and in so much trouble, but it's kind of I don't know what the right word is, whether it's comforting or warming or inspiring, or there's something beautiful about all those families sitting around visiting and just sitting there and trying to help out. I just feel like life at its best is rough enough. And so the fact that that it's so easy to make it worse is a real problem.
Yeah.
And the fact that people, you know, I don't know if it's anybody's fault, you know, there are not multiple generational homes here anymore.
Right.
I was talking to somebody, you know, I had a friend who's passed away now, who's, when she was older, she said to me, if I could, I'd move to Ireland, because it's charming to be old in Ireland. And I met a woman from Africa last night who was talking to me. We were talking about the play, and she said, we were having a similar discussion to the one we're having now, and she said to me, you know, in Africa, people like to get old because they have all the authority. Everyone waits to get old so that they can be in charge and be the most respected person in the room and be the most just the person in the room who everyone looks to, and it's completely different. And so when people get ill, there's this huge support system because you're the most, just because you're if you're the oldest person, you're the person at the top of the,
and you have the most food chain. Wisdom.
You're the most wisdom, or even if you just have some respect because you're older, and it's
It's sort of the opposite here.
It is kind of the opposite. You just pushed off to these communities that are, you know, all older people, which is a sort of a false community to live in. Everyone's the same age. You're put in assisted living facilities, nursing homes. You're just not involved in life in the same way.
And your past is erased in a way.
Yeah, and your past is erased, and it's really valuable for everyone. It's really interesting, and it's valuable. It's enriching of you know, to know what happened before you were here. Really informs your intelligence and your insight about what's happening now. People who have no sense of the past don't have a very accurate sense of the present. They think this is it. This is all that anyone ever, you know, when they have ideas, they think they're the first ones to have them.
Yeah.
When they're morals, they think they've hit the pinnacle of morality because they happen to be alive now. And they don't realize that in 10, 20 years, everyone's going to be looking back at them, appalled at their behavior.
at morals in general.
Yeah. Maybe. So, and it's just, there's also like different colors from the past. I mean, it's a tremendous... It's just a stupendous amount of stuff, like the cultures and the personalities and the way people walked and talked and dressed and the music they listened to and the ways they thought and the ways they addressed problems. It's this incredible treasure trove of anything you might want to look for.
And also thought, too, that, you know, in balancing that, the honesty of the comedic element of somebody becoming repetitious or losing is a real thing, and I think that it's an interesting line to sort of ride, that there is humor in it and there has to be humor in it.
Yeah,
or how would you even deal with it?
It's been said many times, you gotta laugh. It's like there's, and also think people are just funny, you know. There are no joke zones in life, plenty of them, but they're in normal life, they're not that common. There's usually somewhere, there's something funny happening somewhere.
Always,
almost always.
Yeah, and laughter, because I do stand up. I mean, there's different qualities of laughter. You know, there's laughter that should be crying, which is the fine, valid laugh.
Yeah,
there's laughter that because people are shocked and uncomfortable, and then there's the nice sort of turn of phrase laughter.
Yeah.
Where they're impressed with the, you know, but it serves a lot of different purposes. Yeah. I prefer the laughter that could be crying myself.
Yeah. I like most of it. There's a nervous laughter, which I don't like, but you get used to, like when you do what I do, you get used to, after a while, like younger writers or directors are like, why are they laughing at that line? And I don't like it when people laugh when something bad happens, like it's they have a nervous reaction. But I know they're doing it because they're having some kind of an emotional reaction, and you kind of get used to it. It's a little bit of it's a weird thing. But like the most dreadful thing will happen in the play, and one person will go like, and you're like, what the fuck are you laughing about?
that's the one that should be crying. That's the one that, like I don't know how to process sadness, and you know, and I'm uncomfortable, and this is challenging, and you know, I'm gonna go ahead and laugh for a second. It's involuntary.
Yeah, I don't like aggressive laughing. I don't like when people laugh to prove they're not in it, or to prove that you're no better, to prove. Yeah, I think it's mostly
morning radio
laughter, or to show off to their friends.
Yeah, yeah,
that's another one I fake don't laughs. Care for. Yeah, fake laughs.
Yeah, the three films you made, not big laughs.
I think I've heard some hearty laughs at those.
No, okay.
When there's in a group, those movies get laughs.
But you're not going for laughs.
Sometimes, I mean, sure. I try to. I mean, I think there's. I never think there's any difference really between comedy and drama. I think it's all the same thing, in a way. It's, you know, almost more than two sides of the same coin. I think. You know, one thing that I think comedians tend to do when they do serious work is they drop their sense of humor completely, and they become quite grim and dull. you know, when they do serious roles, they're just kind of trying to prove to everyone that they're not only funny.
Yeah,
and I find
they're actually uncomfortable and totally insecure.
Yeah, but they think they think their gift is not worth as much as they don't think so much of what they can really do. And I don't think there's much. And I get a lot of real life value from comedians through comedy, and I don't think it's in any way a less valid way to react to life or to channel your experience through your own perceptions and your own ability to put it back out in the world in some interesting way that no one else can. And I don't know why. I mean, I think I know why they do it, but I think they're mistaken, because
Why they do what?
Why do they drop their senses of humor? Not why they do serious roles. Why they do serious roles so utterly humorlessly.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I don't like to trash anybody specific. I'm not a...
Well, I mean, it's a rare occurrence that like that comedians act in serious roles. It doesn't happen all that much.
No.
And I've noticed...
Some like to do it, and they kind of flip back and forth, and you're just dying for them to be serious. Well, okay, I'll give you an example. Because like when Woody Allen did his first serious movie, it was called Interiors.
Right.
And his balance is now shifted, so he does his sense of humor is laced through even his more serious films. But that first movie he did, which did have some good things in it, only Maureen Stapleton had any sense of humor in the entire film, and the rest of them were just grim, looking out the window, bleak, humorless, and it was kind of dead because of that.
Yeah.
But
he had to find the balance.
He did have to find a balance, but his first instinct when he did a serious movie, part of his energy went into proving he didn't just have to be funny, and I think it's a sort of a, there's no need for that. Like,
yeah,
it's not something you need to turn away from Most of the time, I think, like when people are doing some form of art or anything, really, to make a statement, a defensive statement in some way, it never quite works because no one else really is bothering to think. No one's thinking, oh, he's only funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, only he is. And it's made him insecure somehow in that example.
Yeah.
To where he had to prove himself in some other way.
Kind of, yeah. And he's not the only one. I just pick it because it was a long time ago.
What I've noticed about comedic people... in acting is some of them, they're so deeply funny that they can't rid themselves of it.
Yeah.
And then you get what you're talking about. You get someone who is so dug in comedically that even when he's doing a serious role, there's that essence that enables them to, either through your recognition of their past work or just who they are, that they're still kind of funny somehow.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it's and there's some actors who can go back and forth, and there's lots and lots of actors who have no sense of humor.
Yeah.
They're no good in comedies. They do the same thing in a funny way. It's the inverse. They're really good serious actors, and then they do a comedy, and they drop their whole sense of reality, and they just kind of mug and wink and overdo it, and they're terrible.
Yeah.
Because they don't think that's... They somehow, whatever insight they have any human behavior drops out because they're trying to be funny with a capital F.
Yeah.
Just like comic actors who are too grim are trying to be serious with a capital S.
Right. Well, I guess the reason I bring it up in terms of, obviously there's funny parts in the movies that are very serious that you've written, but I mean, knowing that you wrote Analyze This, which is like, I love it.
Yeah.
It's a movie I watch repeatedly.
Yeah. I've never seen it.
But you were writing up.
Yes. This,
comedy.
Yes. But again, you try to...
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Why?
Because it was rewritten. It's a stupid... Oh. It's a stupid... I don't know who I'm trying to... I mean, it's funny because I'm very... The Jane Rosenthal, who produced the film, is a really good friend of mine. She's been very good to me. It was just rewritten. It was one of my first Hollywood experiences, and I wasn't surprised at all because I knew what I was getting into, but it's been rewritten. It's rewritten by 14 people.
Really?
It's not really a word of mine left in it except the title. The idea behind it is mine. Originally, the kind of humor that's in it is mine. So I take some credit for it, but it was just rewritten, totally out of my...
Oh, so I can't even hang any of it on you.
No, not really. No, but I've seen bits of it, and it does seem very funny to me. So, but yeah, I mean, even when you're writing straight up comedy, even if it's even like the Marx Brothers, who don't have a serious moment in the whole film, there's a genuine emotion in those films, and the emotion to me is how much they like screwing around and how much they like mayhem and how much they really like it. And that's a real reaction to the world. You know, they don't like anything too stuffy. They don't like, and it's not, they're not just out there to knock down, you know, social pretensions. They really just like, they just love to be insane and stupid and silly, and they're really good at it. And that's, to me, a genuine feeling that comes strictly through their being funny, and is just as valuable a reaction to the world as anybody else's.
So if you turned your sort of, has your, because, you know, they obviously reeled you in to do a couple big Hollywood comedies. They Analyze This and That and I guess Bullwinkle.
Yeah, well, that was an assignment. I mean, you got to make a living. So,
right. And have you turned your back on that?
No, I mean, I still do rewrite work. I haven't lately in the last couple of years, but up until 2 years ago, that's how I make a living for the most part, is being a script doctor. Cause I haven't made a lot of money off my own movies because the more money that gets put into a film project, the less creative control you have.
Right.
Now I probably would have more than 10 years ago, but so I try to keep those things separate.
So they give you scripts to give it a little,
yeah, or you get an assignment,
doctor it up a little bit.
Cause you always get fired.
Yeah.
So you can't get too precious about it. You can't get too attached to the material.
When they give it to you, are they sort of like, can you make this a little more real?
Sometimes they'll say, can you make it more funny? Sometimes they'll say the characters are no good. Sometimes they'll say both. Usually when I do a rewrite, they are after better dialogue and better characterizations. And then I do my best, and then they fire me and someone else rewrites it.
Intellectually, though, when somebody says that about a character, like when, because where'd you come up at? What theater did you come up in as a playwright? Where did you start writing?
I started writing in high school.
Theater?
Yeah. I had a really good theater program in my high school, and I was interested in writing plays in ninth grade, and I really liked it, and that's what I always wanted to do. And then I went to NYU, the dramatic writing program at NYU, but I only went there because I thought the homework would be easy, because I was already writing a lot anyway. And my parents wanted me to get a degree, and I didn't care about that much.
Your parents were, or profession?
Well, my father was a physician, you know, he was an internist and a geriatrician. He was a doctor. Yeah. My mom and stepfather are psychoanalysts.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you have brothers and sisters?
Well, yeah, I have a large extended family.
You do?
Yeah.
And being in the household with psychoanalysts, because, you know, yeah, I my first wife was a kid of a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and they sort of get a bad rap sometimes, you know, as oddballs.
Sure. But yeah, my parents are not oddballs particularly at all, I would say, and, you know, they don't practice at home.
What did you feel?
Like,
but what did you feel you got out of that that would have been different than other people?
I don't know.
Self-investigation?
I think, you know, there's a general interest in the house and personalities and different kinds of people, and but I can't say that doesn't exist in other kinds of homes.
Sure.
But that certainly existed in my home.
Is that what, because it seems that in order to be someone interested in creating theater, you'd have to have those interests.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But who knows? I mean, I'm the only person with a professional artistic bent in my whole family. I have three step siblings, a brother, a half brother, and adopted sisters. And my adopted sister is a storyteller and writes. But the rest of them are doctors and lawyers like that.
Well, maybe they're just afraid.
I don't think so. But everyone's in, you know, I have two brothers who play the piano, and everyone's got artistic interests.
So
it's different when you're doing it for a living.
Right. So you start writing in high school and you go to NYU.
Yeah.
When did you start producing plays?
After that, I joined a theater company called Naked Angels, which was a bunch of actors and writers coming out of NYU.
Who were they? Who's in that I know?
Oh, probably a lot of them. Fisher Stevens, Rob Morrow, Nancy Travis, Matthew Broderick, Robbie Bates, Joe Mantello. A lot of these are theater people.
Joe Mantello. Yeah, and they all did okay for themselves. Yeah, the ones you're naming. And that was a situation where you'd write and you'd workshop.
Yeah, that was like they had a little space on 17th Street, and we'd do one acts and sketches and evenings of short pieces and you know, some full productions. And it was a great place to be. You know, there were a lot of young theater companies in the late 80s and 90s. And, you know, like Atlantic Theater, which is a really nice theater, went on to become a legit off-Broadway.
That's Mammoth's theater. Place.
Yes, he was involved in starting it, and he still has a relationship with them.
It's weird. I talked to him, and I...
I heard that interview. It was really good.
I thought it was challenging, because, like, I find him a fascinating guy, but I don't love his approach to actors.
No, I don't either. I think it's a misstep. It's a very strange to me. I mean, again, it's the way he works, and, you know, there are many things that are great about him, but I don't understand the idea that only the writer comes up with characters, only the writer has a point of view about the people in the show, and that everyone should just say the lines flat. I don't understand that at all, and I don't think it works.
I don't either.
And he's another one, I think. I mean, again, I don't like to talk badly about people who are alive and working.
Well, should say critically.
But critically speaking, who asked? But I mean, I think he had an incredible talent for dialogue, probably better than anyone's. And I think he took it a bit for granted, like it didn't mean that much. Hmm. And he started to explore other areas I think because he just thought anyone can write dialogue, or if you can write dialogue, it's just a gift and it's not worth that much. And I don't agree. I think he had a tremendous insight into the culture, into people's behavior, into all the things he's interested in. And it was through his incredible ear. And I think it's something that's worth cultivating and hanging on to, although not, you know, it's not my business to tell anyone what to do.
and I would imagine he's not the kind of guy who's going to take any advice either.
No, of course not. He's got his own stuff he wants to do, and more power to him.
Yeah. But your dialogue is, you also have the gift for it, but it's so dramatically different.
Yeah, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not really trying to make a point. I don't really have an agenda to push. I don't mean that he does, but I mean, I think what I try to do, what a lot of people try to do, is explore certain areas, you know, look at different aspects of things that I'm interested in, or that I might have an insight in that somebody else, because they're not me, might not have. And I, you know, I don't feel like it's my job to answer questions or to decide how people should do things, or just, I don't know how the world should go or what people should do. And I have my opinions, and I'm sure they seep into my work, but I mostly think it's a question of, you know, part of what you do is look at patterns that you happen to see, because you're the only one looking at things from your point of view. And if you can get those, if you can find some of the patterns and connections in life that are interesting to you and that you have some insight about, and get them into a dramatic form, that's something worth doing. It's fun to do too.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to come around to in terms of your evolution, is that when somebody says that there's a problem with a character, I mean, when you approach a character, or where you're exploring a character, because like Margaret is a genius movie, and as a character study of a teenage girl, that because it's so fresh in my mind, and like I'd heard about it, and I didn't see it, and I knew there was some sort of problem with the movie, that you had a problem with it.
Yeah, well, there was a long editing struggle. I'm very happy with the way the movie turned out.
You are.
If you watch the extended edition, I don't know which one you watch. There's two. There's the theatrical release, and then there's the longer extended edition, which is much better.
I watched the one on iTunes.
I don't know which one that is. I hope it was. They're both available. Well, they're both long. One's really long, but it moves much faster. It doesn't feel as long.
No, I hope. I don't know if I watched the right one.
Well, I don't either, but...
But my question is that we have something like that, where you have this teenage girl as this character, you know, who has, you know, conflicts that are not necessarily unusual outside of, you know, cradling a dying woman in her arms at the beginning of the show. And outside of that, you know, divorce, you know, daddy issues, whatever.
Yeah.
But in order to support or to build around this character and the behavior, what is the process of taking that character, building it out, and then surrounding it, what you surrounded it with? How does that start to construct itself?
Well, that was an interesting, really fun to write. And I think I just started out with this girl who had, my first idea, which didn't really make it into the final film quite, it did, but in a very adjusted form, was this girl who, you know, she causes and is right there for this terrible accident, in which a woman is killed, and a bus accident. And she, the first idea I had was that this bad, terrible thing happens that she felt that's very traumatizing, that she's also partly responsible for, and she lies to protect herself and also the bus driver just on the spur of the moment. And then my first idea was that she would then go to all these adults and ask them what to do, and none of them would have an answer for her. And that idea, when I tried to write it, collapsed, because I, you know, if you really think, you know, I try really hard to think what would really happen if this was real. And I thought, well, of course adults would have advice for her. Like, they might not have the right advice, which is when it ended up, nobody had a solution that really was complete, because there is no solution that's complete. And that's what she goes through. And then that slowly built into this idea of, I don't know how, but it built into this idea of living in a city where everyone is somewhat connected and everyone is not. And just the simple idea of, like, we're sitting here and there's, you know, probably 5,000-10,000 people walking around very near us, and they're all having a very different experience from the one we're having. And some of them are going through really serious things, and some of them are playing frisbee. And I just got very interested, especially in a city like this where everyone's in such close proximity.
And that's how you shot it. That these scenes where you see, like, she's a person among people, whether it's in an audience or walking down the street. Or any that there was a lot of focus put directorially on like, you know, there are all these people
on everybody else.
Yeah.
One reason this film was so much fun to write and to shoot, I wish it had been as much fun to edit, but that got into political struggles with the studio and the producer. But was that, you know, it's a little hard to describe. You have, you know, Werner Herzog says his ideas are like burglars who come into his house. He doesn't really feel responsible for them. They just occur to him and he doesn't know where they come from. And I feel that way when things are going well. You have quote unquote have an idea, and then, but it's like this idea interests you, and it's almost the way another movie would interest you, but it doesn't exist, and you have this impulse, you want to put it on paper, you want to put it out there and make it, you want to create it, you want to have it, you want to give it some shape. And then if you have an idea that's really exciting and interesting to you, to me, let's just talk about myself, then you try to follow the trail of what your interest is without even necessarily knowing what it is. Yeah. And you have other ideas that strike you as right, and then you have ideas that strike you as wrong, and you don't always know why. But if you kind of trust that there's something inside you that's trying to get out, and you try to listen to those signals, you try not to try to listen to when you're bored and when you don't think it's any good, and you try to listen to when you're interested and intrigued, and then you find all these themes cropping up, or all these storylines or all these ideas that are connected to each other. So one of the things in that film is the whole idea, when you're a teenager, your life is very serious and dramatic, and part of it is very sincere and deeply felt, and part of it is this big show you're putting on because you sort of feel like you're in the middle of a TV movie. At the same time, teenagers are very passionate, very, 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 they're not inured to life, they're just discovering it. And Elaine May actually said to me, you know, this girl is trying to right this terrible injustice that she's caused, and that nobody else is, that, you know, she goes to the police, she goes to these lawyers, and she can't get anyone to acknowledge that what she did and what this bus driver did is something that should be recognized as a terrible thing and dealt with in some form of justice. And she struggles very hard to find some kind of, anyway. So then Elaine May said to me, she said, only a teenage girl could think she could affect the world that much.
Didn't you have a teenager at the time you were writing it?
No, I have one now.
Oh.
Not quite as not quite as vigorously anti-parent as the character in the film, but it's, you know, that's, again, it's one of the areas the film looks at, is the way kids can be so, you know, your first move into independence is to decide your parents are hypocrites and phonies and shallow, and eventually you kind of circle back and realize they're just grown-up kids, and they're just trying to figure things out the way you are, and that you're no better than they are, really.
Yeah.
Unless there's something unusually wrong with them.
When you're trying to solve problems of character, do you realize these nuances specifically?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is instinctive, and part of it is following this hidden trail, and part of it is once the trail is revealed to you, you then follow it up more consciously. But a lot of that, there's a sort of a half conscious state you get into when you're writing, and the really smart, insightful part of everyone is not necessarily the part that's on the surface. You know, there's something that connects you to other people or to your own ideas that's a bit more unconscious. And I think, you know, I kind of like to compare it to an athlete. Like, when they're really in the zone, they're not thinking about every, you know, a basketball player who's playing really brilliantly is not thinking about every shot. He's not thinking about where the ball's going. He's just in some kind of groove that nobody understands. And when you're writing well and acting well and playing music well, I think you get into a similar groove, and no one really knows what that is. It's not magic. It's a very powerful and consistent side of being a human being, but nobody quite knows what it is.
But it's also like within the craft that you've chosen that, you know, you keep trying these things out, and you put things on stage and you process it.
Sure. And when it's not happening, it's really awkward, and you're trying to, like, you know, you have a great scene and scene A is great, scene C is great, scene B sucks, and you're just like, how do I get from A to C without fucking everything up?
And then it becomes like math, emotional math.
A little bit. And then, but part of it is thinking, well, what really would happen if scene A was real, really true, what would happen after that? And yeah, would they in fact go into the, would they go get a cup of coffee? No, they're fighting too much. If I write this big fight scene, in order for them to then have a cup of coffee, as I've written in scene B, something has to change. So I may have skipped a scene.
Yeah.
There may be a scene where they reconcile, or they have an appointment. Something concrete has to happen to get you from one point to the next if it doesn't make logical sense the first time you write it.
Yeah.
And
so it must be easier to think about that when somebody sends you an already thing that you didn't write the original. And you're looking at these characters, and you can just say things like, "Well, this, like, as an observer."
Yeah, it's a little easier to do it with someone else's. And sometimes I think it'd be better to kind of adopt that kind of journeyman attitude towards my own work. It might come a little more easily.
Like if you're able just to detach first draft.
A little less precious about it and not trying to dig so deep all the time, because it doesn't always work. Sometimes you're more shallow characteristics carry you through better.
Let's talk about a little bit about directing, about Manchester by the Sea. You've done these three movies, and they're very specific. You know, there's I can't remember where You Can Count on Me takes place. Where
it's a small town in upstate New York.
And then in Margaret, that's here.
Yeah.
In the city. And then like Manchester by the Sea was, and I spent a lot of time in New England, you know, I started comedy there, went to college there. It's a very specific type of life and person.
Yeah, it sure is.
So why there? I mean, when does it, you know, what is the seed of that?
Well, that was a little arbitrary. That was more like an assignment, which you're given something and then you just dive in and that, you dive into that point. The idea of the film was Matt Damon's and John Krasinski's, and they came to me with this idea. They wanted me to write a script from, and it was their first idea was this story takes place in Manchester by the Sea, where I'd never been. It's a small town north of Boston, just next to Gloucester.
Gloucester.
And I said, sure. They said, put it anywhere you want. I said, that sounds good to me. So It was a sort of a backwards.
Okay, so, right.
Well, but then it became mine very quickly. But it was a kind of a backwards process. I started with a place, and then I learned more about that place. I'd been in Gloucester a few times, and I have some relatives in Massachusetts, so it wasn't totally alien to me. But there was a certain amount of research.
So, what was the story they said to you, that this guy causes the death of his kids in a horrible accident? Run with it.
They said. Well, their idea was he's kind of the town character, and he accidentally, his daughter. He's taking care of his daughter and she chokes to death while he's out putting out the trash. She's in a high chair, which is pretty grim. And then he leaves town, and then when his brother dies, he comes back to take care of his young nephew, and they form a relationship, and it's kind of his redemption is to come back and take care of his nephew. So that was the bare bones. Now I threw out quite a lot of that, and I actually made the accident that happened worse than what they had imagined. And I tried for a while to write him as a town character, and it didn't work at all. So I had to switch out his personality completely before I could go forward.
Then he becomes this town myth.
Then he's a town notorious in the town for having
done this horrible thing.
Been somewhat responsible for this, another film where there's an accident the main character is responsible for, but this is worse. It's not totally dissimilar. There's a certain, some, I thought it was a really good idea right away. And then there's a certain amount of material that they had suggested that I didn't do anything for me. But I had this assignment, and I had to write it, and I needed the job at the time, and I liked the idea, and I love Matt, and I like John, who I don't know as well, and I really wanted to do this. So I kept fishing around till I found other material that connected to their idea, which I liked as much as if it had been my idea.
Fishing in your head?
Yeah. I was like, well, I don't like the main character as I've written. He's very flat. He doesn't do anything for me. I don't really see who he is. But I had written a brother character for him who I really did like, who seemed like a real guy in my head. And to me, he was a real person. So I got rid of the main guy and I switched the brother to being the main character just in my head. And then I was like, okay, then I felt like I had something more robust to work with. And then I gave him a different brother. And then I had a little family that I believed in and was able to proceed. it's kind of like you're following clues that are coming up from your own mind. And that's something I've, over the years, that's, if I have any kind of technique, that's my, that's what I try to do, is follow my interest. And if I like the character of Lee instead of the character of John, who it started out as, then I know that's going to yield something valuable.
I find it so interesting that, like, you know, in specific, I guess my, it's not really a question, but I don't know how it happens. Maybe it's just an acute empathy or perception of human nature. But, you know, the codependent relationship of the brother with the heart condition with that woman, mm-hmm. and her character, mm-hmm. you know, is a very specific and I think a very disturbing and real thing that, you know, does, and that just happens for you in your mind, or do you, like, you because, like, it seems psychologically sound.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also Casey's character, you know, with alcohol, you know, that there's something about that.
Yeah, well, I hope it is. I mean, it's certainly supposed to be.
Yeah,
I
think it is, yeah.
I mean, but that's what's interesting. I mean, I've had people say lots of nice things to me, and one nice thing people say is, I like how your characters are not good or bad. And my feeling is, first, thank you, and then second, like, who do you know who's all good or all bad? Like, I don't know anyone who's like, yeah. that. There's some really rotten people in the yeah. world, but even they have friends and relatives who
they have shitty friends or shitty relatives,
or they're nice to their dog. You know, I mean, that it doesn't exist. Someone who right. is like in the movies. There's no person sitting back cackling. Well, yeah, it's sentimental to think a villain knows he's a villain. He doesn't.
Yeah,
you know, the most villainous people in the world think they're right.
Yeah,
and think they're. Yeah. Or they're aware that they don't care about anybody else, and they think that's fine.
Yeah, we have a president.
Yeah, but he's sure he's right about everything. Yeah. Everyone is. That's what's so maddening. Also, this is not just to be cycle. You know, it's more dramatic to have two people who think they're right arguing with each other. When I see a movie and the villain is cackling with glee, you know, laughing because he's so evil, I'm like, this doesn't do anything for me. It's yeah. not, it's weak.
Right.
He's not real. It's much more frustrating to deal with somebody else's alternate reality than it is to deal with someone who agrees with you that they're no good.
Yeah.
And so it makes for better drama, I think.
And when you're directing, how do you, as a writer, you know, what's your approach to directing? Is it because, you know, you're pretty, you know, it's straight ahead and it's, you know, beautiful, and you do have an appreciation, obviously, of the environment, but is it there to service the writing and the characters in a basic way, or do you approach direction with some sort of craft in your head?
You know, my whole goal was to make it as vivid and lifelike as possible. Whatever the story may be, that's what I enjoy doing. So, to me, the environment is really, it's such a presence everywhere you go, like the room we're in now, or just sure. my drive up here, or just when we go out into this noisy horror outside.
I don't know what the hell's going on out there.
It's just daily life now. But if you get in a car and drive an hour, you're suddenly you're out of New York, there's a sky opens up, you could be in one of these depressed little towns in New York State, you could be in the Hamptons where it's very zhuzhy.
Yeah.
And it's just suddenly different, and the environment really seeps into everything. And I'm really, you know, I, for some, whatever reason, I'm always really interested in the physical environment that the characters are in. So that's one way to kind of bring the material to life. Also, you know, life is very specific. There's no real such thing as a generality in the world. Everything yeah. is very concrete and specific. So my way into these stories is to be as specific as possible. Means doing a certain amount of research and thinking as accurately and vividly as you can about the people and what's happening in the room between them. And some of it comes to you as if by magic, even though it isn't. And some of it you have to work on and figure out and kind of plod through till you come up with something that you like.
And what's your approach to, you know, actors?
Pretty much the same. You know, I have an idea of the story that I think works, because I wouldn't have considered the script finished until I do. And then when we're working on the scenes, you kind of tell them your version and hope they can use that as a jumping off point. And most of the time they can. And then there are things that I know are happening in the scene that if they don't pick up on, I will point out to them. And then there are always things that they know that I never thought of. And that's the fun of working with actors, is that they bring so much to it, so much more to it than I could.
So it's fully collaborative in your mind.
Very much so. Yeah, they're not. I mean, they're without them, there's nothing. It's one thing to imagine all these things happening and all these people, and it's another thing to actually embody them and become them. And you know, what they have to do is tremendously difficult and interesting. And I just try to, you know, like for instance, if there's a couple and I've written them as insulting each other and they're meant to get along well, sometimes people who are not naturally sarcastic and mean like I am will make a little smile after they insult their imaginary spouse or yeah. brother or sister or parent
right.
in a scene. And I will say, listen, I think you're close enough that you don't have to make it clear that it's a joke. You've known each other for 10 years. And when you kid around, there's no need to soften it by smiling. And to me, that suggests a greater intimacy. That's something that anyone can understand, and they'll stop smiling and something will spark between them that wasn't there before. So that's the kind of thing I might say. And then all other time, if it's going well, I don't say anything.
And Casey wasn't the original guy?
No, Matt Damon was going to play first. Yeah, Matt was going to play the lead, and then his schedule got too tight. And we could have either delayed for 2 years or gone ahead with Casey. And Matt and I both agreed Casey was a great idea if Matt couldn't do it. So we offered it to Casey, and luckily he was able to do it.
It's kind of hard to imagine it any other way. And they're both great actors.
Yeah, that's the funny thing that happens. You know, you write it and you can put various people in it in your head, and then when someone really comes and embodies it, it's hard to imagine anybody else doing it.
When you're shooting those scenes, like I'm sure the one scene that you probably talked a lot about was that scene with Michelle Williams and mm-hmm. when they first see each other after all those years.
Yeah,
I mean, when you're on set and you see that thing unfold, it had to.
It's great, you know.
More than anything you could have ever imagined.
Yeah, it is. And they're just, you know, they're just both so good. And they
I think about it,
so
I get
much.
Choked up.
It's a great scene. And, you know, I like the writing in the scene, but the performances are what makes it. And it's just really, they're so alive and the situation is so painful and they're trying so hard to. Again, you know, I think the scene would have been less good if one of them, you know, one thing people like to write a lot is fights, arguments. You watch TV and they're always, or any movie, you know, they always start out, they're snapping each other, they're always arguing. And I'm like, and it's just easy to write a fight scene. And I think that it's, people don't fight that much or that openly in real life. They do, of course, but they do a lot of other things too. And these two characters are really trying to be nice to each other, but they're at terrible odds and they can't connect. She's desperate to connect and he's desperate not to, so they can't. But another thing that's happening is that they're both very conscious of not trying to hurt each other. And I think that's kind of what makes the scene so strong, because the way they both perform it is so, there's the conflict between what they want to do and how they're trying not to wound each other in doing it is impossible to sustain. And he eventually has to walk away. I think it's great. I love how they do it.
Yeah.
It's very exciting on the set to watch that happening.
How many times did you have to do it?
We did a few takes. We had two cameras.
Yeah.
We scheduled it for half a day, 'cause we knew it was a big scene. That's a long time for a movie like that. We probably did about five takes. So you'd have one, you'd have Kate over Michelle's shoulder shooting Casey, and then also a two shot at the same time, and then the reverse.
I see. I feel bad for what I said about comedy earlier, because I realize that when you say that there's not that much difference or any difference between drama and comedy, is that in a piece of work, that if there are laughs in something like you do, they're earned and they're completely within context. Where you write something like Analyze This or whatever, you know, you're writing jokes. But
right.
Like when I think about the relationship between Casey's character and, you know, his brother's son, there's a lot of comedy there.
Yeah, there is. And it's, but it comes, I hope it there is.
Yeah, no,
it comes,
definitely.
But like you look at somebody like Scorsese, who writes, you know, who makes these films about these very violent, extreme, but he loves extremity and behavior, and his movies are incredibly funny. People are so far out, even if they're these ruthless murderers,
right.
It's really funny somehow because he's so enamored of extreme behavior. Or you look at Stanley Kubrick, whose movies are not thought of as being particularly funny except for like Dr. Strangelove, which is a flat out comedy. He's got this incredible sense of humor. I don't know what it is. It's a sense of irony or just this strange, like, I don't know. But so a lot of people do this, you know, Pedro Almodovar, the great Spanish director. Movies are incredibly funny and incredibly moving. And there's just, it doesn't, it's not that thing where it's funny and then there's a serious scene and then it goes back to being funny.
Yeah.
It's all woven in together.
It's not shtick.
No.
And which is not, what was, which is sort of makes sense that, you know, that, that Analyze This got so far away from you, because there are scenes in there that are so shticky that I have to respect them as shtick.
Yeah, like that, there's like nothing wrong with shtick. I love it. It's great. I mean, my, but like, look at a show like The Honeymooners, which is the single greatest television show ever, in my opinion, and it's really funny. But there's a real, their relationships in it are very real, and it's not
character.
The characters are great, yeah. And they're really believable, even though it is essentially a sitcom. And I think it all goes together very well.
So what was your experience with the, you know, in terms of where you're at now and what you can do with the accolades you have? Well, an Academy Award's not nothing.
No.
But in terms of, like, I'm curious about the experience. What held up Margaret so long?
It's a very long story. It's not very interesting, but it was essentially, it was a very difficult movie to edit. It would have been anyway. It's a very different kind of movie. It has a really unusual structure, and the length is, it really needed to be longer than it was contracted for. And that was the fulcrum of where the conflicts were. And they basically didn't believe I was going to get it to them at the right length, or that it would be good at the right length. They wanted me to get it in on schedule at the right length, which was 2.5 hours, and have me be happy with it. And I tried really hard to do all three things, and I couldn't. And I was able to keep it on schedule. There was a series of contracted extensions, but that sounds stupid because it took 5 years to do, but it was all mutually agreed upon delays.
Yeah.
And it just built up from there. We didn't trust each other. We didn't like each other. They didn't give me the leeway I needed to complete the film because they didn't trust me, and I couldn't understand that wasn't something they wanted to do, because my feeling was if they just leave me alone, I would get it done and it would be really good. The one thing they didn't want to do was leave me alone. They tried everything but that, and even after we'd been fighting for 2 years, they'd say, what can we do? I'd say, leave me alone. And they'd say, why would it be different now? I said, because you've never tried it.
Yeah.
And so it just, nobody would back down. It was impossible, as it turned out, to give the film to them at the length they wanted and have it be any good. I didn't know that when I started. They thought I was conspiring the whole time to give it to them at a longer length. There wasn't. And it just built on from there. And there are many chapters to that story. I would take all
but
day.
You're happy with the director's cut.
I'm very happy with the extended version. Yeah. It's still not exactly what I would have wanted. There's some music there that I don't like. There's some edits there that I don't like. It's much, much better than the other version. It's much closer to what I wanted. It's about, I'd say, about 80% of what it should be. And usually I like to get up to 90, 95%.
So Manchester by the Sea is a 95%.
90. I think it's about 10 minutes that could come out of it. And there's a couple of things in it that I don't love. But mostly, I think it's really pretty much what
it is. Why are those things in it?
Because you lose, it's hard to, you know, you have to finish it. You know, you can't keep tinkering with it. First of all, there's a point at which you get to where your fixes start to make it worse. And you don't understand why, but once that happens, it's really time to lock it down.
Yeah.
It was further along in earlier cuts than I realized. I spent about 6 months making really minute changes that didn't make it better. And then after that 6 months, you have to release it. There's a release date. You can't keep screwing around with it forever. And you're not confident that your fixes are going to make it any better.
So that 10% is inexplicable to you in the sense that you don't know what the solution is. But
no.
All right. Well, that's an acceptance.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it's out of your hands.
It's out of your hands to a certain degree.
When it was in your hands.
Yeah. It's the same with writing a script. Like you can see where it needs work. You keep working on it. And then at some point, the balance tips and you see that you're making it worse. So you have to stop, even though some of it's still not satisfactory.
So there's no being satisfied.
No, I'm very sad. I think I'm more satisfied with most of my work than most of my friends who do the same thing. I'm really happy with, you can count on me, I'm really happy with Manchester. A little I have a couple of little quibbles with it. You can count on me. I have two quibbles with it exactly. There's just two scenes that I'm not crazy about.
Yeah.
I cut one scene that I should have kept in, and I changed one shot that I should have left the way it was. But
you don't wake up at night thinking.
No, but I'm always annoyed when I watch it.
When it comes on.
Yeah, but I'm very happy with my plays. I don't think they're perfect, but I think they're mostly really good, and I like the way they've been performed, so I'm pretty satisfied.
I'd love to see a production of Lobby Hero, but I haven't.
Yeah, we had it was a really good one last year. That's I don't think it's possible to be completely satisfied, especially over time when you get a little better, hopefully, at your job, or you're a different person. It's just, you know, working on this stuff is like a question of stepping in and stepping back, and eventually, you know, you're up close working on it, and then you step back to look at the whole thing, and you see it a little differently.
But at some point, as you get older, you accept what you've done, and you can see that that's where you were in your life, and that those issues. Has it ever happened where you've had issues with something, and you realize, well, no, it actually is okay?
Yeah, many times.
Yeah,
yeah. You kind of, these details start to loom very large in your mind, and then you realize all the time. I mean, that's partly why it's difficult to edit, because your mood changes. So you look at one scene and you're like, this is a disaster. Or you're worried someone else is going to think it's a disaster. And then you look at it a week later and you're like, oh, it's fine.
As a playwright, I mean, if you wanted to, you could go in and in this new production of the Waverly Gallery, you could change it.
Yeah, you can. I mean, there are three or four things I would cut from this script, but I'm not that confident I'm right. And part of that's because you're different when you're really connected to it, to the point where you're able to work on it. And I have, and it may be superstition and it may be wrong.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, for most of my working life, try to respect what I was doing at the time and understand that I couldn't do it now just because I was at a different place psychologically. I was really in the groove of whatever that project was, and I maybe don't know as much now about it as I did then.
The feelings are different
and the insight is different, and I have a different view of it because now it's different. It's not something I'm working on by myself. Other people have been involved, other people have seen it's become a different animal.
And what was your involvement with Gangs in New York?
That was a really good time for me. They had been through three writers. The last guy who'd worked on it, his name is Hussein Amini, who's a really good writer, and he was only able to come in and do some patchwork on it, and then he had to go off. And they asked me to come at the very last minute and rewrite some of the characters and dialogue. And I just got married. They flew my wife and I to Rome, my wife and me to Rome, and we lived in Rome for 3 months, and I went to the studio in Cinecittà every day and worked with Scorsese and Daniel Day-Lewis and Leonardo DiCaprio, and it was really fun. And I love period stuff. I love, I'm really interested in the Civil War. The whole set was just incredible to be on. It's blocks and blocks and blocks of this reconstruction of 19th century New York City slums. It was just incredible. And we just had a really good time. Everybody else was freaking out about the movie, and I was having a blast.
Yeah, it's like exciting.
Yeah, it was really exciting.
Yeah, in those moments, because I'm shooting, I have a very small part in the Joker movie. So So I'm going over this first time I've met De Niro.
Yeah.
Of course. And, and I'm doing a scene with him for like 30, 40 seconds.
It's cool.
But it's like it's something else.
Yeah, yeah.
But like even in watching them work, I mean, was something planted in your brain about that process and about working with actors and about directing? Or were you just so thrilled to be there that you didn't really, weren't looking at it that way?
No, a little of both. I mean, you can't help but absorb what's happening around you. You know, this was a big, big movie. And to watch him, Marty, like, I call him Marty. Everyone calls him Marty. I'm not showing off. I haven't seen him for a while, but we got to be pretty friendly. That's good. He's been really, really good to me. And I love him. But to watch him manipulate all the elements of this enormous production and to keep his eye on it and to not just the production, but the people and the whole thing, and to design these shots. I didn't get to see him working with the actors too much because he would basically go off and talk to them quietly. So I didn't ever knew what he was saying to them, but kind of watch him riding the performances from the monitor or in the editing room later. And it was fascinating. And just watching the different way the actors just approach the parts and the process of redoing the rewrites was interesting.
How so?
Well, I'd mostly done rewrites not, I'd never done rewrites on the set while, you know, I was rewriting about 2 weeks ahead of the schedule, which was pretty intense. And he just had this really good system. I'd meet with him and the actor involved, and we'd all talk about the scene and what was wrong with it and what they wanted.
Was Daniel Day-Lewis in character all the time?
He did that voice all the time.
Yeah.
But he seemed to me to be very nice, and the character isn't very nice.
Right.
And on the weekends, he dropped the accent, and he told me later that I don't know if his second son had been born yet, but he had a kid at home, and he didn't want to come home and be this sinister Bill the Butcher, which he would have done before he had children. So he said it was the first role he ever did.
Just put his wife through that.
Yeah, just put his wife through it. So anyway, so we'd sit there and we'd talk about the scene, and then I'd go off, I'd show it to Marty. When Marty and I were happy, we'd show it to the actor, and then everyone, it was just sort of a very good system of circulating everyone's notes till everyone was happy.
So where's your what areas of your brain are sparking now in terms of what you're writing now? Where are you headed?
Well, I have a screenplay I'm interested in that I'm trying to get off the ground, and I have a play,
an original
screenplay. I have a play that I would really like to write. I have no idea if I can or not, because it would be quite a challenge to try to put it together. It's if I ever write it, it's a historical.
What period?
Piece, 4th century.
I don't know what that is.
It's the late Roman Empire.
Uh-huh.
It's a 4th century AD, and I don't have any idea how to put it on a stage, and I probably won't be able to do it, but it's a period I've gotten really interested in lately.
Why?
I don't know. I was always interested in history. I was always interested in Roman history, among many other periods. I like medieval history, I like 19th century history.
You're going to write in that dialogue?
You can't write dialogue from... I can't write 4th century Latin or Greek, so no. But that's one of the problems, is how do they talk?
Yeah.
One of the many, many problems. I don't think I can do it, but I'm learning a lot about the
what
period.
Kind of human story can you place then that you can't place now?
It's a totally different world. It's like saying, what kind of human story can you place in the deep south that you can't place in the Soviet Russia? I mean,
They place Shakespeare in all kinds of different environments.
Sure. Maybe it has to be done in a modern way. I really have no idea.
Uh-huh.
It's very, I mean, I don't even want to say it's early in the process, because I don't know if there's going to be a process.
And what world is the screenplay in?
Well, the truth is I'm a little uncomfortable talking about stuff I haven't written, because I don't want to talk it away.
Yeah, right. That happens, right?
It does happen.
You keep talking about it. There's nothing
left to do.
Yeah. So what do you do during the day? Just write?
I try to write. I do crossword puzzles. I read.
Yeah.
I.
Do you freak out?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Not in an internal way.
How are you handling the world?
It's horrible. I don't know. I don't know what to do about it. I think about it a lot. Probably not as active about it as some people. I don't know what to do about it. It's pretty bad. It's a little hard to know how bad it is. It's one scary thing about it, because, you know, I have a friend who, we had an argument, pretty casual argument, because I said, I'm not so sure. He said, this is the worst administration. This is the worst presidential crisis we've ever had. And I said, I'm not sure that's true. It's happening to us right now. I don't know how bad it's going to get. It's very bad now, but I don't know if this is going to, you know, if you think about, if you had been, you know, if we had been alive and grown up in 1969-70, the world looked pretty grim then. We had this terrible war. The whole country was, there was a series of assassinations. Terrible problems, riots every summer, bombs going off everywhere. It must have looked like a complete collapse to people at the time. And he said that he didn't agree. He didn't think Nixon was as bad as Trump. And I don't know if he's right or not. We're not in a war. We're not in a major war. There's all these small, there's all these smaller, horrible conflicts all over the globe. We're not in a big, major war. We're not in the middle of an economic crisis. We're not having riots and race riots and, all kinds of other riots. We don't have the police gunning down union workers who are, you know, there's a lot that's not happening that has happened. It doesn't mean that it's not going to get very bad, but I don't know. And the other thing is, I was going to say, like, you also look at, you know, the most extreme example you can think of, the rise of the Nazis and their consolidation of power. you know, you say, why didn't the Jews leave as soon as Hitler came to power? Well, they didn't know how bad it was going to get. It happens in increments. So you don't really know what we're up against yet. And some people...
So you're saying it's going to be hard to know when to leave?
It's hard to know what to do or how... I mean, I think the thing to do is to agitate and try to vote out the
right
rabid conservative cynics that are in power now. And you've got to try to find some way to... find some kind of civilized accommodation with all the people who violently disagree with each other. I don't know how to do any of that, but and it's got to be done. But I, in terms of just prognosticating about how bad things are going to get or how bad this is in the big picture, I don't really know. It's quite bad.
But as an artist, like right there, what you said, like, you know, like it would seem that on some level, it doesn't necessarily seem that this is your starting point for creativity. But, you know, bridging the gap between, you know, these ideological tribes,
yeah,
seems to be rich territory, and obviously a lot of people talk about it,
yeah,
and I guess some people would say, well, I'm going to confront that or, yeah, or explore it through characters, and that's not the way your brain works.
You know, you can only write about what you can write about. You might want to write about lots of things, but I'm not, you know, there's some things you're better at and some things you do more naturally. And I don't know, you like to think that any kind of connection that people make through fiction with other people is valuable, even if it's just to give people, I mean, and I think there's a value in entertainment, you know, some people think it's a narcotic, and I suppose it is, but I think there's some, you know, people need to have something to watch on TV when they come home, or to read about, or to go to the movies, or to go to a play.
Arguably too much.
You know, right now. I know, but it's not something you'd want to do without. Mm-hmm. You want people to think and have a real experience, at least I do, when they go to see my work. And I don't know how... I do think there's some value in trying to understand somebody whose point of view is totally different from yours. I don't know that you get that a lot in entertainment. I think you get a lot of, you know, where is the right wing point of view in the entertainment world? It simply doesn't exist. And I'm
fallen stars on Twitter who people assume have gone bad.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I often wonder, I've wondered for many years, way before Trump, what I had this idea of putting on a really right wing oriented play in New York City and seeing how tolerant all my tolerant friends were to another ideology.
Like a totally jingoistic play?
I don't know, just something that presented a conservative point of view as reasonably as possible.
Yeah.
And I know they'd go insane.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of a lot of stretching that needs to be done on both sides. I do think you're right. I think this is a tribalistic aspect. I mean, frankly, none of us want Trump to do well at anything. We just want him gone because he's so awful. So I would bet that most of my friends, including us, you know, I assume you have the same, since you're in show business, I assume you have a similar political ideology. But like the fact is, I get a little depressed when I read how good the economy is, because I don't think about all the benefits that are accruing for people. I think it's going to make him more popular. Yeah. The bad one is winning.
Yeah.
And that's a really unhealthy attitude. People, you know, and people...
He would agree with you.
People, it is unhealthy. People on the left are every bit as knee-jerk and regimented in their thinking, and as people on the right, we like to.
They're
think
not as disciplined, and they're not as focused, and they correct. Don't have a long-term view that they engage.
That's correct, and we hope that our values are better. Mm-hmm. But so do people on the right. I'm not a relativist. I don't think it's all the same thing, but you know, people on the right can't understand how we can feel that we're moral when we're against every single thing that he does. But to us, I think it's not he's not something that should be tolerated. He's a very, very bad guy. He's a pathological liar. I mean, I don't have to go into all,
right,
for this audience especially, I don't have to go into the whole story, but so how tolerant are you, how tolerant should you be of McCarthyism? Not at all is the argument. But then you're accused of picking on everything poor old Joe McCarthy says, but he was a self-serving, climbing liar. He didn't even believe anything he was saying.
Yeah. So none of that conversation that you just we just had, you know, including putting on this play, that's empathetic and sensitive to a conservative viewpoint.
Yeah.
You know, engages you enough to rise to the occasion.
I think about it all the time. You know, as I say, you can only write what you can write about. Yeah. I have not seen very many plays, movies, or read very many books that have a specific political message that they're trying to convey that are any good.
Right.
To me, I think that's journalism, essays, speeches, conversation, people. I'm not here to make a point, because if I'm making a point through the medium of a drama or a comedy, unless I'm very clever, I have a really good point to make, I'm essentially using the people in the story as puppets to disguise the fact that I'm putting forth some kind of particular ideology.
Right, I understand that.
And if I have something to say that's a declarative sentence, I'm better off just saying it instead of spending 2 hours pretending some other people are saying
making
it.
Up a shallow character.
Right.
Exactly. Well, it was great talking to you, man.
Oh, you too. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, really thanks fun. For doing it.
My pleasure.
That was good. I enjoy talking to that man. Again, his play, The Waverly Gallery, with Elaine May and others, is playing at the Golden Theater through the end of January. Guitar? Sure.